Good afternoon. My name is Kenneth Lee. I'm a judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and I'm honored to moderate this final showcase panel, the Law, Science, and Public Policy. Before we begin, I want to thank Dean, Julie, Evelyn, and all the others who've helped arrange this conference. I know it takes a lot of time and effort to make this happen, and we appreciate it. Also want to thank all the people here, the audience here today, because this is the last session on the last day of the conference. I know you guys are probably tired, and judging from the activity at the hotel bar, some of you may be nursing a hangover as well, but you made it, so thank you for being here. I think today's topic is a very timely one. I think over the past couple of years, we've heard the buzzword or buzz phrase, follow the science. We've seen bumper stickers or internet memes saying, you know, I trust science. And some scientists today are like celebrities. They're famous, people respect them, and you see them all over the TV and magazines. And for those of you who read that intellectual journal, Us Weekly, you may be familiar with a section called, you know, celebrities, they're just like us. You know, and they show a photo of, you know, like Tom Cruise walking his dog, or Sean Penn buying a cup of coffee before he punches someone in the face for taking a picture of them. And I think scientists, like celebrities, are just like us in some ways. We respect them, but they're not infallible. They may have their own biases, and they may be subject to pressure. That being said, I think, you know, everyone agrees that science needs to play an important role in our in crafting public policy. Today's session, we will discuss, you know, how can we ensure that science plays an appropriate and proper role in crafting public policy. And we have an eclectic and all-star panel to discuss this issue. First, to my right is Professor Stephen Benner. He is a serial entrepreneur in biotechnology. He served as a professor of chemistry at Harvard. I think his tie might be of the periodic chart, I believe. If you can't see that. He's been also at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology and the University of Florida. Today, he directs a biotech company managing the current pandemic, and he also presides over a nonprofit called Foundation for Applied Molecular Evolution. As a government major in college, I have no idea what that means. I suspect most of you also have no idea what that means. And if you did understand what that means, you're probably at the wrong hotel. I think the Federation of American Scientists are meeting at the Hyatt across the street. But we're happy to have Professor Benner here today. Finally, we have Christina Sandifer. She is the Executive Vice President at the Goldwater Institute. She is the co-drafter of the Right to Try initiative, which is now federal law, which protects terminally ill patients their right to try safe investigational treatments that have been prescribed by their physicians but are not yet FDA approved. Her most recent book is called Cornerstone of Liberty, Private Property Rights in 21st Century America. The format for this is each panelist will provide an opening statement for 6 or 7 minutes, and after that, I think they'll respond to each other's points, and then we will open it to the floor. We want this to be very interactive, and I think this will be very informative and fun. And I think Professor Benner will start.
So is the microphone on? Yes, yes, it is. Well, as Judge Lee pointed out, I am a high priest of the new religion called science, and now that you know this, you are all obligated to trust me, otherwise you will be deplatformed, shunned, and perhaps even unemployed. This topic today I'm looking at as an experiment because I was curious to see how the legal profession, which I gather is represented in the room here, this is a group I don't usually talk with, but how the legal profession would respond to an admission by a scientist, a frank admission by a scientist like myself, that in many areas, from climate to COVID, the scientists do not publicly offer our best good faith assessments of reality. when it comes to policy, and more on that in a minute. As many of you know, ever since about the Second World War, there has been a covenant between the body politic and scientists where the politic supports us with very little control, except perhaps by peer review done by the scientists themselves, but in return expect to have basic research breakthroughs that eventually lead to useful things, like the atomic bomb, or for that matter, environmental sound policies or medicines. And of course, that covenant has been wildly successful, but in public policy, the covenant really relies on the willingness of scientists, when asked, to give what we think to be our best good faith representations of reality, perhaps with caveats. And that part of the covenant has, over the last couple of decades, been largely destroyed. So climate science, of course, offers the best example, the best documented case, but COVID really exemplifies how the corruption of science costs lives. And I'm going to have a few words to say about this, but let me give you a couple of examples. There are propositions that people who have reason to know, have an opinion on, have the opinion that these propositions are true, but they cannot say them in public for fear of being deplatformed, shunned, or unemployed. So, for example, in climate science, this is not the warmest year on record, not even close. That's generally accepted to be true, but it's something that we can't say in public. There are the rise in global temperature that so concerns Al Gore or Greta Thunberg actually started in 1750 and was two-thirds over before carbon dioxide from human sources became a factor at all. Again, everybody who has a reason to have an opinion on this subject knows that that's likely to be true, but we can't say it. The Paris Accords, by the way, they're innumerate. There is absolutely no reason to believe that they will have any impact at all on sea level or any of the other things. Those are all true statements. And now, anyone who has reason to have an opinion accepts these propositions, yet if they say them in public, they risk deplatforming, shunning, and unemployment. And so politicians, even politicians on the right, this is not a left-right thing, Boris Johnson, a conservative from the United Kingdom, Aaron O'Toole, the conservatives from Canada, all adopt policies in climate that have absolutely no basis in science at all. And that's because of the way in which information has been transferred. But COVID is really the case, and it's a timely case, where the goring of science has caused deaths, okay? Everyone in the position to have an opinion at all knows that first, COVID-19 was likely the product of human engineering. Second, that it was likely circulating in the United States before the first cases were identified in the United States. And that the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration forced public health surveillance to be blind in the first 3 months of this pandemic. And so let me amplify on that last point. I mean, my lab, we were aware of COVID. We had COVID assays running in February 1st. We knew about COVID because we had participated in the SARS scare in 2003-2004. But the Center for Disease Control required that all COVID tests be done in Atlanta. And I have no idea what their legal authority was for requiring that. But they were scientists, and therefore they were trusted and obeyed. And then the Center for Disease Control set up CDC-approved centers around the United States and distributed a CDC-approved test kit. That kit did not work. This is a political advertisement because it did not employ our chemistry. So our chemistry was available to secure our campus in March. It received regulatory approval in April in India. Not in the United States. We did not get a regulatory approval in the United States until August. And just last week, Rochelle Walensky at the CDC said, and I'm quoting now, masks can help reduce your chance of COVID infections by more than 80%. And that's a statement with absolutely no scientific basis whatsoever. I don't even know what that statement means. But it has been, even today, you can go outside, the Mayflower will tell you that they are enforcing CDC recommendations, right? If they were in any other field, not scientists, you would not regard them as scientists or authoritative. You might regard them as, you know, having been failed bozos, probably, in outside of the field. But such is the trust that you folks give to scientists, and so I'm interested to see what you folks have to say about that.
want to talk about why we must choose, at least in the context of law and government, individual autonomy over science-based paternalism, for lack of a better term. And I will focus mostly on medical autonomy and the medical side of things, at least in my initial remarks. So first, medical autonomy is not only, in my opinion, a cornerstone of medical ethics, it is one of the most basic ideas of freedom guaranteed by our Constitution. And if you think about it, if you own yourself, which is what our governing system says, at least in theory in the United States, if one owns oneself, then they have to have the freedom to make these personal, intimate decisions, or otherwise you do not have the freedom to exercise any of your other rights. And there actually is a long line of cases that supports, to some degree, medical autonomy. So we've got cases from the Supreme Court that recognize one's right to refuse life-saving treatment. We have cases recognizing one's right to refuse unwanted bodily intrusions, one's right to care for one's own health in person and seek out the doctor of their choice, and on and on. Now, of course, a lot of these cases are limited to their facts and don't go very far beyond that. But some of the lower courts have even gotten into some really interesting issues. For example, the right to choose whether or not to cut your own hair. So we have a long line of tradition in the courts supporting the right to medical autonomy to some degree. But unfortunately, we also have a growing tradition both in what is accepted in governing and also what the courts have then accepted from government. And that is a system that prioritizes the preferences of public policy decision makers or even scientists vis-a-vis public policy decision makers at the expense of every person's right, really to shape their own destiny. Moreover, questions about how we choose to live our lives, those to a degree really aren't scientific or medical questions at all. And that's where I think there's a lot of confusion when we have discussions like this and we talk about following the science. Science answers questions about reality, but it doesn't answer questions about how people should deal with this reality. And scientific experts may be experts in their field, but they aren't experts on people's individual values or risk tolerances. So, for example, in the case of medicine, whether a drug is acceptably risky for a particular person to take, that isn't a scientific judgment, that's not a medical judgment. Instead, that's a normative judgment that's going to vary from person to person depending on their circumstances, their risk tolerance, the benefits that they expect to derive from taking that treatment. And that's why government officials can't just follow the science, so to speak. That there's many qualifications to that for that very reason, because they can't effectively determine what risks or benefits are applied to a particular population as a whole. So what we get is decisions that, in my opinion, end up being very disjointed, very arbitrary. So we have a system of medicine, and this is just broadly speaking, that on one hand allows folks to take dangerous medicines, medicines that I don't think anyone would argue are not dangerous, so something like chemotherapy, which, you know, is essentially poison, even acetaminophen, Tylenol, right? That kills hundreds of people a year. So we have a system that allows people to take those risks. We have a system that allows people to end their lives, at least in some states, with a doctor's help. And we even allow people to be paid, healthy people, to be paid to volunteer to test medicines whose risks we have no idea, that could be very dangerous and even fatal to them. But yet, in many cases, we also, that same system also forbids people from taking treatments that could alleviate suffering or even help save their lives. And so it's very arbitrary, very disjointed. And nobody has perfect information. And that's another thing I think to remember when we talk about following the science, because you can have multiple people claiming that they're following the science and coming to very different conclusions. And if you backtrack, it may not be the logic that's the problem. It may be that the premises actually differ. Where there are unknowns, again, the principles of medical autonomy dictate that we have to defer to the risk tolerance of the individual. No system is going to insure against all risks, including our current system. Many, many treatments that are approved for safety and efficacy by the FDA are later pulled, are later retested. Just because something gets the stamp of approval from our federal government does not mean it's going to be right for every individual, does not mean that it comes without risks. It's impossible to insure against all risks. So again, the question comes down to who decides whether the level of risk is going to be acceptable to a patient? Is it the government or is it the patient herself? I think the question of information and allowing for the free flow of scientific information is a separate but also important one. The Coronia decision came up. I think that I have a different take on the outcome of, or how, on how the FDA has interpreted the outcome of the Coronia decision. But I think this is a very, very important area to pay attention to, because censoring or withholding scientific information doesn't just hurt patients or consumers, it also violates constitutional rights to free speech. And in the context of medicine, this is particularly important because we not only have a government that is actually blocking patients from making certain decisions about treatments, but also taking away the tools, in my opinion, that patients and doctors need to be able to make those well-informed decisions. And that's what is so frightening, especially in an era where we have more access to more information than ever before, some, of course, very helpful, some, of course, very unhelpful, and we have people who can pick and choose what information gets to patients and doctors. So in the context of off-label treatment and the discussion of that, that's what the Coronia decision dealt with, and there is this anomaly in law. Again, if you look at things from a free speech perspective, that says that off-label treatments are treatments that are for, you know, purposes or patients or dosages different than the federal government has approved. Those treatments are legal. Prescribing them is legal. It's actually very common. But yet, under certain circumstances, federal law prohibits manufacturing companies from talking about those off-label treatments or promoting them. And I consider this to be a gag rule. Again, I think it's very harmful to patients and doctors and insurance companies and the like. And there is this line of cases where the courts are consistently saying that you can't prosecute speech. If the conduct is lawful, then the truthful speech about the conduct also must be lawful, because otherwise you're flipping the First Amendment on its head. We don't typically see in the law a situation where we see that conduct is lawful, but speech about that conduct is unlawful. And in my opinion, the FDA has continued to ignore such rulings or distinguish them in ways that only lawyers could love, right? When the Coronia decision came out, the FDA said, okay, well, we're not really prosecuting speech. What we're doing is we're using speech as evidence of the crime of misbranding. Well, what is branding if not speech? That is really a distinction only a lawyer could love. But, you know, we can laugh about these things, but the real-world reality is that we now have scientists or pharmaceutical companies or others who are terrified to bring up or to discuss information that could actually help people for fear of criminal prosecution, and the fear is real. I've written about a company called Vascular Solutions that had truthful communications about the lawful use of varicose vein treatments. And they were prosecuted for making that truthful speech. It took 5 years and $25 million of the company's money and time to be able to eventually clear themselves of any wrongdoing. And at the end of the day, what came out of that? What innovations were suppressed because of the time and money that was spent on that litigation when nobody actually did anything wrong? That is not listening to science. That is suppressing science. So there's a lot, obviously, that we've all spoken about. I really look forward to the Q&A and further discussion. I guess I would just say that my takeaway from this very broad topic is that there's too much focus on whether or not government is following the science. And I think that, you know, that results in rather than ensuring a free flow of scientific information so that people can make their own decisions, which is what our Constitution empowers us to do, we are moving toward government as the decision maker so long as they can justify their actions in terms of following the science. And I would posit that rather than asking what is the correct science or whether government's following the science, we should be focusing on narrowing the scope of government action itself, properly constraining it, and deferring to the individual when there are close cases. So thank you. I look forward to this discussion.
Thank you for the very interesting and provocative views of all the panel members. I don't know if anyone wants to directly respond to any of the other panelists' thoughts, if anyone's itching to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we agree on the fact that there's an asymmetry there. I think just agreeing on whether that should be then, you know, that the FDA should regulate more or regulate less is probably where the question lies. And I think it's important to think about why the FDA doesn't regulate or require the same kind of proof every time a prescription is prescribed off-label or medicine is prescribed off-label. And just imagine, I mean, we've all heard the statistics that it can take 10, 15 years, billions of dollars to bring a drug to market. Some of that is R&D that the company needs to do. A lot of that is, you know, getting through the clinical trial process that the FDA has imposed. Now, imagine you do that, you know, for one set of the population, you do that for adults, or you do that for adults with a certain disease, or you do that for one type of cancer, and now you get that drug to market. Now you've got to turn around. We know that a lot of cancers are different, but they respond very similarly to the same treatment. Doctors are experts in their fields. Pharmaceutical companies know from continued testing these things. Now imagine if you had to take that drug all the way back through that process, another, you know, potentially 5-10 years, $500 million. It would make these drugs inaccessible and cost prohibitive for patients when there's no need to do that. And at the end of that process, you got to keep in mind, I'm not saying that the clinical trial process isn't helpful or important, but in some ways it's kind of an arbitrary, you know, phase to meet. And at the end of that process, there's, again, no guarantee that that treatment is going to work for that particular individual, that particular kind of cancer. All of this is a little bit more of an art than a science in some ways. And so, again, I think at the end of the day, we have to think about what does this mean for the individual who is trying to alleviate suffering or, God forbid, trying to save his or her own life.
You know, I find this conversation cute, adorable. Right? I mean, Western civilization post-Enlightenment has been based on the notion that we can develop a knowledge of the world around us doing a process that, among other things, involves self-doubt, a little bit of humility, and doesn't accede to authority. Now, I've just told you guys, I mean, obviously there are many historical examples. Lysenko comes to mind. Of course, the Darwinian evolution, you know, did a real number on political theory, I mean, leading to Margaret Sanger's eugenics all the way to, you know, National Socialism, anti-Semitism. I've just told you, as an expert, in two areas that are core public policy, right, that the science is corrupted and that you're descending into a dark ages because you don't let scientists tell you about COVID or coronavirus, and you folks are adorably discussing what you are as your academic. I mean, I've read, you know, I mean, Glenn's has a very famous brief called the Lander Brief, which is involved in the Myriad cases. One of his, I mean, I've read this. I went back and read, Christina, your amicus for the hallucinogenic drug case, and right, it's all fine, but the underpinnings of science, in fact, the underpinnings of nanny state, is that the nanny is going to be Mary Poppins, not Nanny McPhee, right? And the argument for libertarianism is not, I mean, it certainly is philosophical as you phrase it, but the ultimate argument is that the people who you give nanny power to are not capable of exercising it correctly. And so, I mean, I would not like to get into policy discussions today, but just give you my best good faith assessment of reality as a scientist, and that is that fewer people would have died of COVID in the United States had there been no FDA or CDC. And the reason And it's a counterfactual. It's hard to prove. But the reason for that is because what would have happened without an FDA or CDC is that every veterinary school, every academic department of molecular biology would have had tests up and running when we did in the end of January. And we would have known what was going on in the public health sector much better than with the FDA standing in the way of that and the CDC screwing things up, because these people are not competent to be our nannies. Vaccines are a fascinating case, right? In 2008, the technology was invented which goes into the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. That's a remarkably rapid turnaround, 12 years to reality. I myself misunderstood. I was indeed expecting to have in 18 months to 24 months at the earliest for a vaccine to be developed. We had a lot of interactions with Newt Gingrich and various other people in the Trump administration with the diagnostics profile, but it appears as if the reason why the vaccine was so effectively and so rapidly delivered was because someone in the administration was pushing the FDA to stand down, to not go through all the whistles and bells. Because the EUA came in diagnostics in large part in response to SARS, where finally somebody figured out that there was a risk of not having a diagnostics. Right, which was sufficient in many circumstances. Now, what has happened with EUA is in between 2003 and 2020 is that the EUA has become more and more like a regulatory process rather than a way of avoiding regulatory process. That's the same thing as right to try, right? There was a law and then basically the right to try. Law has been eroded by regulatory
system. Yeah, and I think another interesting aspect of what you just said is the lack of focus on testing and approving testing rapidly. And, you know, I can't speak to how many lives would have been saved had that not happened. But what I think is another important aspect of that is the snowball effect of what comes from that in other government regulations. So because we had a CDC and an FDA that were very slow to approve testing because we did not have state level or local level authority to be able to approve and administer testing, which is something that my colleagues at the Goldwater Institute have advocated for. It was very difficult for people to get tested. Therefore, it was very difficult to identify who actually had COVID and who did not. And so what is the response then from state governments, local governments, even the federal government? Well, it's to take the sledgehammer rather than the scalpel approach, right? And that's why we see lockdowns of various degrees. We need to just keep people away from each other. And since we don't know who has it and who doesn't, well, I guess we're just going to have to tell everybody that they have to stay home. And, you know, the economic consequences, because we have to remember, too, this isn't just, you know, healthcare doesn't just operate in a vacuum, and healthcare regulations don't operate in a vacuum. So the economic consequences of this, the mental health consequences, I mean, are astronomical, and we will spend decades trying to measure them. Yet, if we had a more permissive, a better system set up where people could have been tested better, we could have had an approach that might have focused more on, you know, quarantining individuals. And I'm not suggesting that is the appropriate policy, but that would have been a more of a scalpel approach, right, to allow other people to go about their business and to have certain people kind of kept away from the general public so that they don't get others sick. That is more of the historical type of response. And frankly, I think that would have allowed people to continue living their lives and to go about, it would have had fewer economic consequences. So I think it's interesting to think about that aspect as well.
No, I mean, there's no question that this is true. But look, I mean, the FDA, for example, requires that a test that is patient-specific, where you're screening asymptomatic people, must be as sensitive as the most sensitive mm-hmm. test. That's a holdover from HIV, mm-hmm. because HIV people can be asymptomatic and still spread, mm-hmm. and the test therefore has to be as sensitive. Of course, it makes absolutely no sense for a respiratory disease, because the respiratory disease is transferred by people who have a high viral load in their sneeze, not to be. And by the way, let me say, for all the government majors here, I can get you all running HIV, COVID tests. I can get you running molecular COVID tests in about 30 minutes, all right? It's not difficult to do. Helen Chu was doing it in Seattle. She was told by the FDA to stand down. We were able to transfer our kits to some people in Colorado. My legal team told me, hey, don't do that unless you want to go to jail, because that's forbidden. what that did was force all tests to be false negatives because the tests were not run. And that, of course, led to, I mean, we have a public space entry test. I have a test that will allow us to sample the COVID burden in this air, not allowed to be used, okay? So the bottom line out of all this is, by the way, not millions, Glenn. We haven't had millions of deaths in the United States yet, but certainly, I don't know the number, right? Somewhere in the tens of thousands would be my guess, but certainly it was quite true that for January, February, March, and April, we were blind as epidemiologists to what was going on out there because of the FDA, and I could have had every one of these people in the audience deputized to be running tests in their local community. Safety and efficacy, as Christina has mentioned, are two very different things. And as a scientist, I cannot tell you what efficacy is in a medicine. A vaccine, I really can't tell you either, although it's easier because there is a metric for how many people vaccinated get sent to hospitals. But no, it's an interesting question. The question is, I was myself, I must confess to my error, in March of 2020 saying that it's going to be 2 years to get a vaccine. Why? Because Ebola had taken us 5 years, not quite the same pressure. Right. I understand, however, that my conservatism also has a risk, and that's the risk of the people dying in the time that it takes to go through the regulation. Now, my view is that if I believe that this is what's wrong with dealing with very intelligent people, right? I became a professor at Harvard, pretty good. I was the youngest tenured professor at the Swiss Veterans of Technology. Professor Benner, I said to myself, you're pretty smart. No, the whole point about science is, of course, that we have to recognize that we're not that smart. And so my view is that I'm not capable of coming up with... I know, I don't usually get applause in my talks. when I talk about, the dipole moment of nucleotide bases in DNA, no one seems to apply. But yes, the point here is that you are in the situation where you're trying to make a decision between an early vaccine, which will kill people because it's not adequately tested, or a late vaccine where people will die because they don't have the vaccine. And I'm not smart enough to make that. And with Rochelle Walensky telling me that there's an 80% chance that masks will prevent me from getting COVID, I don't believe a thing she says anymore.
Sorry. How would each panel member grade the United States government's response to COVID, whether it means following the science or balancing science with other public policy considerations? And since we have a couple of academics, maybe we could grade it on a curve and take into account maybe what the rest of the world did. I think I know what your grade would be.
Ask Nassner's. You've got that. Well, look, hydroxychloroquine. If you published a paper in the U.S. jurisdiction, where it was not allowed to be in favor of it, you are 3.4 times more likely to come up with a negative result than if you published a paper outside of the U.S. jurisdiction. This is an analysis of metadata, and it's a statement that scientists changed what they published in response to political pressure. Right? It's better. We wish that Trump had kept his mouth shut, because we would have at least gotten a fair evaluation of that medication, which I happen to think is not a very good one, but that's just my personal opinion. But lousy. And in Sweden, of course, there are other. We have wonderfully done lots of experiments around the world. I'm delighted we experiment with people's lives. Experimental scientist, that's wonderful, but we have not done particularly well on the curve.
So as the non-academic on the panel, I'm reticent to give letter grades, but as the practicing lawyer, I will answer with it depends. if we're talking about the vaccine development, I tend to agree with you. I think the government deserves high marks primarily because it mostly got out of the way. I think the testing, it's terrible, right? I actually would disagree on the federalism. I think that the states needed more authority to be able to act and respond to what was going on in the various localities. I think they have more authority. I think they needed more authority. I think when we look at the way some state governments behaved, though, I would give them quite high marks, because I think we saw something really remarkable. One of the sort of silver linings of COVID is this is one of the worst health crises that the United States has seen in some time, and yet all of these regulations that exist on the state level that were justified, as government is supposed to justify regulations on the basis of health and safety, were miraculously not needed or were actually even standing in the way of public health and safety. And so we got rid of things like restrictions on telemedicine, right? People being able to consult with doctors without actually being there in person, restrictions on licensure that made it hard for medical professionals to move from state to state. And as we scaled these things back, I mean, even silly things like, restrictions on whether or not restaurants can offer carry out alcohol. And we scale all of these things back. And then we realize, this was actually better for our public health and safety, and we probably can just make these reforms permanent. So on the state level, I think many states did quite well. I think the feds, it's a mixed bag.
And on that point, do you believe that given our experience with the rapid approval of the vaccines that this will be the future in terms of government approving? And also I will say, if folks here have any questions for the panelists, you can start lining up and can field some questions as well.
Well, I am optimistic that given the Right to Try movement, starting with, of course, the AIDS crisis back in the 80s, Right to Try movement, COVID now, I'm optimistic that more people are paying closer attention to these types of regulations. I see more patient advocates than ever paying attention and demanding smarter regulations that get access to patients quicker. So I think there's going to be, I think it's impossible to go back to the way things were. I think there's going to be a demand for change. Now, the question is, we're in Washington, D.C. right now, where good ideas go to die. So, how quickly are they going to implement those ideas? I don't know. But I do think that we're going to see a lot more movement on the grassroots level. I mean, that's how Right to Try got where it did as quickly as possible. And by the way, Right to Try was not the be-all and end-all. It was just the start, I think, of a lot of this. But that's because it really was a grassroots movement that started in the states. You had almost every single state in a short 5 years passing these laws saying that patients have a right to try these unapproved medications, and Congress could no longer turn a blind eye. And I think we're going to continue to see that type of advocacy, hopefully driving some change in the future.
Yeah, my comment would be that I think that COVID is a wake-up call. It's an example that the anti-science, or the lack of availability of actual science to public policymakers in the area of climate change, is going to be a far more expensive and ultimately far more damaging than it has been in COVID.
I found interesting the discussion of how we would have done without the FDA and the CDC. I wonder if we could change the hypothetical just a little bit and say, what if we deliberately privatized the function of the FDA to something like, for example, underwriters' laboratories for electronic devices? Private entities could potentially fill the gap and offer private certifications of medicines and things of that nature. Would we have been better off through the crisis had we taken steps to privatize those functions before the pandemic?
Yes.
Personally, I think they destroyed public trust in the vaccines by censoring and suppressing science and information, by damaging the integrity of science through the whole process. I think if we'd been without the politicization of the science, I would have been much more readily accepting of vaccines myself. But I don't know how many people would agree with me on that.
Yeah, it's hard to measure that, of course, but I tend to agree with that because we all have anecdotal evidence of that, of conversations we've had with people who, seem unusually reticent to take this vaccine, given, maybe the likelihood that they would take other vaccines. And I think it really does come down to just a real public distrust in government, which I think generally is a healthy thing. But I think could probably be avoided when you have independent reviews of these sorts of things. And we see that, by the way, right? Look at all of the things, that are not regulated by the FDA, that fall completely outside of its regulation, nutritional supplements and things like that. A lot of these things are totally unproven and tested, frankly, because we have the FDA system, and if they don't have to go through it, well, then, you know, they don't. Whereas if we had a privatized system, I think people would pay a lot more attention to those sorts of things. And people do pay attention. There's a lot of nutritional supplements that have a stamp of approval from, you know, a third-party private organization that will go in and do independent testing and say, hey, the ingredients that this company says are there are actually there. And personally, I pay a lot of attention to that. And that's true of everything that we do. I mean, from the types of restaurants that we go to, you know, when you go to book a hotel, people look at reviews, they look at independent assessments. So I think there's no reason for us to think that healthcare is or should be any different.
Nothing corrupts the public perception of science than the impression that a committee, nay, a government committee, is standing between you and the primary scientist. NASA, there was a discovery of phosphine, not important, 3 atoms of hydrogen, 1 phosphate, in the atmosphere of Venus, and someone argued that this was a signature of life on Venus. What did NASA do? They established a committee to make sure that unauthorized, non-consensus claims of life detection would never occur again. That corrupts the public perception of science.
Well, now we'll alternate here, and we'll go to the back row to the gentleman next to Bob Uecker over there.
Hi, my name is Ethan Yang. I'm a 1L at Scalia Law School. I'm also with the American Institute for Economic Research. My question is on the use of unsettled or clearly politicized science when it comes to arguing for the rational basis test when it comes to the state's use of the police power. I think one emblematic example would be Catholic Diocese versus New York, where Justice Gorsuch, writing for the majority, basically, you know, ruled that then-Governor Cuomo's lockdown policies were very arbitrary and therefore unconstitutional. But then in dissent, Justice Sotomayor said Justice Gorsuch doesn't even begin to consider the consensus of her public health experts. Right. So I was just wondering, in the case of, you know, clearly politicized science, and obviously this will continue when it comes to climate change, what have you, how should the legal profession really approach science when it comes to justifying things on the grounds of rational basis?
You tell me.
Well, I think you've pointed out one of the problems with the rational basis test, right? And again, when we have one of the myriad problems, but when we have a system that, you know, tries to determine, well, first of all, as we know in rational basis tests, there doesn't have to be any basis, and the way we achieve that doesn't have to be rational. But rational basis tests correctly applied by courts, you know, at the end of the day, then you get a battle of experts, and we've discussed, you know, how you can come to multiple different conclusions. And that's why, again, I think in the case of the law, that shouldn't be the starting point. Shouldn't be, okay, well, you know, is this based in expertise and which expert is right? Again, we've got to look at the principle of autonomy, the principles of freedom, people's individual rights. And this, by the way, is another is also a problem with bifurcating rights, because we've touched on this just a little bit, where you have a situation where something, a mandate, might be legal because we say that it supports health and safety, but then there's an exemption for somebody based on their religious views. And it seems kind of bizarre in some ways. If this is necessary for public health and safety, then, you know, why do we allow some people to be exempt simply because they follow the right kind of philosophy or the right kind of religion? And I think, you know, this is the problem with treating different rights differently. We have a higher standard for free speech and religious freedom, which is why people try to couch things in terms of that, versus when it comes to my own right to medical autonomy or economic freedom or property rights, there's a lower standard. And frankly, they should all be. All rights should enjoy the same protections as free speech rights and religious rights.
Good afternoon. My name is Nick DiBenedetto from the New Jersey Lawyers Chapter. My question is specifically for Mr. Benner. Can you talk about, from your perspective, what needs to happen within the scientific community to reduce the reticence to speak and to share the conflicting data? One coming out of law school just recently might naively think that the hard sciences and your very data-driven approach would make you guys a little bit more immune to this sort of thing rather than equally susceptible to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was just 4 years ago on a panel over at the American Council of Trustees and Alumni where my panelist was Alison Stander, who had invited Charles Murray to speak at Middlebury and was rewarded by being sent to the hospital by a concussion from the violent protesters who did not want to study child psychology. There are different, and she turned to us and said, yes, we are expecting STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, to lead us out of the wilderness in this area of political suppression of political ideas. And of course, in the area of child developmental psychology, that ship has sailed. In the area of climate, that ship has sailed. You cannot get grants, tenure, or promotion if you say, for example, that the global warming that so concerns us began in 1750 and was two-thirds over before carbon dioxide became a factor. And we know that because Judith Curry at Georgia Tech said that, and she was forced out of her position at Georgia Tech by Kim Cobb and various other people who subscribed to the science is settled denier. These are two phrases that were introduced by Al Gore that basically destroy climate science. So yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I do think that COVID is a sufficiently flexible field right now that you can still find people in academic areas who do not get concerned about losing tenure or losing promotions or grants by making accurate statements. But I think that in child psychology, in particular climate science as well, that ship has sailed.
Judge, if I may petition the court, it looks like we have a question way in the back of the room that I think we might have been missing that third microphone.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Jack Etheridge from Ohio. And in August of this year, City Journal published an article called Do Masks Work? By Jeffrey Anderson. And in the article, he concludes that 14 of the randomized clinical trials that had been done that tested the effectiveness of masks in preventing the transmission of respiratory viruses, only three suggested but did not prove statistically significant evidence and intention to treat analysis that masks might be useful. He went on to say that the other 11 suggested that masks are either useless, whether compared to no mask or because they appear not to add to good hand hygiene, or actually counterproductive. I'm not an anti-mask person. In fact, I love my commemorative Federalist Society mask. But my question is this. Given these conclusions, which seem to be pretty valid scientific conclusions, why is it that mask use is so much focused upon by governments and regulatory agencies?
Okay. So you want to take... Glenn and I have had a back and forth on this. So do you buckle your seatbelt when you get on an airplane? And if you do, who do you think you're fooling? Now, there is, of course, right? There is an energy that below which is put into the airplane, the seatbelt has no effect. And there is an energy above which, if you put it in the airplane, the seatbelt has no effect. But there is actually an energy that goes into the airplane, turbulence, something where the seatbelt is useful. And that's why you do it, because there's basically low cost. There have been studies, there's one in Bangladesh, there's one very well often studied in Denmark, which show 0 to 18% some low effectiveness of masks. My reason why I think a mask is a good idea is because it gives you the impression, just like when you buckle your seatbelt in an airplane, that you're doing something, that you have some degree of control over your fate. And that has psychological value, which is not to be minimized.
I think we'll go into the middle row over there.
I just wanted to ask, do you note the major change that's occurred here with the CDC and the FDA overriding clinicians? This is brand new territory, and it's of great importance to me in two areas. Not only overriding the clinicians, my daughter had COVID early enough before they even had testing to know what it was. So the doctor sent her home with what he would normally have sent her home with, which was prednisone and a Z-Pak, and this actually saved her life as she was going MIS. If he had followed the current FDA guidelines, he would have sent her home and said for me to bring her back to the hospital when her lips turned blue. And furthermore, with the CDC focusing on useless things like masks, because COVID is 0.15 microns to 0.6 microns, unless you have an N95 on, your mask is doing nothing. With them focusing on masks and vaccines, which I think the jury is quite frankly still out on, they have ignored things like UV lights and MERV 13 filters. And I spoke with somebody from the Army who said to me, oh yes, upper UV lights work fabulously, but we gave them up once the vaccine came into play. So should this vaccine fail, we don't have UV lights where they deserve to be, and we have clinicians who are afraid to prescribe things such as ivermectin, a $6 pill that they use quite effectively in India, but yet they were looking to grant approval to Pfizer's $700 protease, very cleverly designed around the ivermectin generic drug. So, but the big, big question is, we have overridden clinicians and scared our scientists.
Right. I've interviewed maybe 200 patient families and coronavirus, it's just to try to get details. And there's no question that if you're above a certain age, a vaccine, not taking a vaccine is probably an extremely bad idea.
I think that just the one thing to add to that, though, is a good point you made is it relates to the seen versus the unseen, or what happens when government makes certain choices, what is it crowding out by not making others? And so I think, you know, that is one of the reasons why, I mean, our extremely cumbersome, expensive, lengthy regulatory process not only adds to the costs ultimately of treatments, but of course, when you approve something and don't approve something else, or when something, you know, when a drug company enjoys IP protection before, you know, generics can come on board, it's just something to think about that, you know, what kinds of costs are you adding, both in terms of financial costs and in focusing resources in certain areas versus others. And that's without making a comment about, you know, the particular things that you spoke to, but that is a very real concern that I think a lot of people don't think about, because we will never know the things that were not made available to us or the resources that were not dedicated to things that could have been helpful simply by virtue of the fact that the government didn't choose them.
Gentleman here.
Michael Buschbacher from Boyden Gray & Associates. One of the hats I wear is an environmental lawyer, and I've worked both for the government, DOJ, and in private practice. And one of the very frustrating things, especially working for a lot of fossil fuel companies in private practice and looking at the public policy decisions we're making, is exactly as Professor Benner points out, that just the sheer nonsense that passes for our conversation about climate and pollution. And I wonder, what's the way that we who work in that area might help to restore the covenant that you mentioned at the beginning of your remarks? Because I'm very afraid for exactly what you mentioned, that we're going to end up in a situation where things are really, really terrible, and unless you're Elon Musk, perhaps. And what are the things that those who are of us who are not scientists can do to help change the way the conversation goes?
Well, I wish I knew, and I wish you guys as members of the political legal community would advise us on this. What is the case right now is that the scientists are themselves self-enforcing the flow of information outside. So if you ask, I mean, when I say anybody who has a reason to know, it's like Christopher Columbus. No, everybody didn't think the world was flat, and Christopher knew it was round. If you asked a farmer, you know, was the world round or flat, they would say, I've never thought about the subject. Likewise, if I were to say to you, was it, in fact, 9 degrees centigrade warmer, 15 degrees warmer 50 million years ago in the Eocene, you would say, I've never thought about it. But that's a fact. It's widely known. Everybody knows it. Everybody also knows that since the last ice age, we're somewhere in the 70th percentile. That is, 30% of the years have been warmer and 70% of the years have been cooler. So, and the coral reefs have done fine. The polar bears did fine. There was not, right? All of this is well known to people in geology departments, but you are not permitted to say it. And if you say it, you will not get a grant, you will not get promoted, you will not get tenure, you won't get a job. Now, how you manage that is beyond me, because remember, the seeds of this were sown 20 years ago when the science was determined to be settled by the political authorities. Very Lysenko is a very good model for that, actually. And then if you were not agreement, you were a science denier. And of course, what a science denier is a scientist, right? Somebody who challenges, right? Now, I don't know how you handle this, right? As I said to the previous questioner, this ship has sailed, right? It's not, climate science is like genetics in the Soviet Union. It took generations for that to work itself out of the system. And I and the fact that you have Boris Johnson, who's a conservative party from the UK, Erin O'Toole in Canada, this is not a left-right thing any longer. This is a university consensus based on no science at all. And I don't know how you handle it at this point because, as I say, Judith Curry is thrown out for saying true statements. When you say true statements and you're thrown out of the academic life, that's quite a tragedy for people in academic life because we don't know how to get a real job.
But it's even more than that, right? In addition to the self-censoring scientists and things like that, I mean, this is another area where we have positive and normative statements, and people fail to distinguish between the two when they make policies. And it is just simply not the case that there are people out there that believe we should have a pollution-free environment. Nobody, no human being that wants to live wants a pollution-free environment, right? No human being that wants to live comfortably. And so, you know, the question comes down to, I mean, even if we can come to a consensus on climate change and what's causing it and what the trajectory is, then the question becomes one of, so what? Right? So then what do we do about it? And again, do we use this scalpel or sledgehammer approach? Do we say, well, you know, we can go ahead and give our lives back to the earth and stop doing whatever it is that we're doing, and then we will all perish. We will not have vaccines and things like that. Or, you know, do we say, okay, well, let's think about the consequences of human decisions and how much, you know, pollution or how much effect on the environment, to the extent that we have those effects, is acceptable to live the type of life we want to live. And again, that goes back to everybody has different view on that. Everybody has different assessments. So that's what makes it so hard for a regulator to just come in and say, you know, well, I'm following the science, and gosh, we have climate change, and so now we've got to stop all pollution, we've got to stop all business, we've got to move everybody to electric cars, and, you know, hold our breath really long.
Go in the back there.
Yes, thank you. My name is Paul Kaminar. I'm a lawyer here in Washington, D.C. The FDA cannot ban the off-label use of FDA-approved drugs. But in terms of promotion, 9 years ago, the Second Circuit held in U.S. versus Coronia, quote, the government cannot prosecute pharmaceutical manufacturers and their representatives under the FDCA for speech promoting the lawful off-label use of an FDA-approved drug. So my first question is, isn't the FDA following the circuit rule on this and other circuits?
No.
They're not following it. Okay, there. They're a lawless agency, so there we go.
That does kind of go back to how people perceive information, right? I think it's just an interesting sort of sociological experiment to be in different geographic areas where there may be mandates and still see a wide number of people just not wearing masks anymore. And then I've actually been in areas where there are not mandates, and I've seen quite a few people wearing masks. So, you know, that kind of goes back to, if, especially for, I think, the bulk of the people who are in this room that just have, and again, an admirable in most cases, you know, just sort of knee-jerk reaction to, I don't want to be told what to do by the government, are these mandates actually counterproductive, and do they get people, do they further erode the trust between, you know, scientists or regulators and the general population?
Let me point out, though, COVID could be different, right? This is likely an engineered virus, which may be one of the reasons why it presents to the public so crazy that we've never seen the symptomatic distribution. But had COVID been like, you know, diphtheria, whooping cough, and any of a number of other things, we would not be wearing masks as a preventative. That we just couldn't tolerate that, right? So if COVID were different, a mask would not be sufficient. And of course, then we would be, it's an interesting question as to how the modern public would require or adapt to an influenza from like 1918. It's a very interesting question as to what we would do as a regulatory legal status if we actually had a really serious pandemic.
Thank you all so much. My name's Elizabeth. I'm a fourth year evening student at Georgetown Law School. I think most of us in this room who are lawyers and right-of-center lawyers came into COVID with already formed opinions about the administrative state and about, you know, liberty interests and all of those things. But I think the average American soured on government science over time. I don't think they came in with that prior opinion. And I think in large part they soured because of this sense that either the scientists are just making it up or they're not being honest with us. You know, Dr. Fauci says you don't have to wear masks, then he says you do have to wear a mask. Then they say vaccinated people don't have to wear masks, and they say vaccinated people do have to wear masks, and they say, you know, COVID doesn't spread in aerosol, and now it does, and COVID, you know, vaccinated people can't get COVID and end up in the hospital. It has a 99% of efficacy. Oh, maybe it's not. Maybe it fades over time. I understand some of this is an aspect of science, right? Science develops over time, as well as science isn't always 100% certain. So why do our government scientists not do a better job of communicating this to the American people? Because in some ways, I think the lack of trust that Americans now have in science is due to the very scientists' own fault in not communicating what they themselves truly believe about these things, which is it's not certain. So what would your advice be to government scientists about how to communicate with the American people, and why do you think they have this hesitancy to express the uncertainty that is inherent in scientific inquiry?
Are you familiar with the male answer syndrome? My wife tells me that if you ask a man a question and he does not know the answer, he'll give you an answer anyhow. Scientists need to say more frequently the four most important words, I do not know, and that's something that scientists say. But I do agree with Glenn that we have been remiss in our education system in explaining what science is, which is centered around uncertainty. And as Feynman says, science begins with a disbelief in experts. But you also have a political process now, which goes back, and Al Gore is largely responsible for it in the area of climate, where we do not express the fact that science begins with a distrust of experts, and the statement, trust the experts, is anti-science.
As libertarians, or from a libertarian perspective, where do you each draw the line between personal autonomy, individual rights, and any obligation we may have to protect our fellow citizens and others?
Yeah, I mean, that is not only a question, it's the question, right? Typically when it comes to these decisions, I do think that there is, I'm a libertarian and not an anarchist, because I do believe that there is a very limited role for government in protecting people's rights. And so I do think that the closer you get to things like, you know, vaccinations or other public safety measures, there's arguably some role for government simply because you are talking about people's decisions that have an effect on others. So where exactly you draw that line, you know, I think I'll borrow the phrase that more people need to be comfortable saying, and that is, I don't know. But what I do know is that we are nowhere near that line. And we've been talking about getting rid of the FDA and the CDC. I wish we were at a point where that was the next question. What we have is a system that defers to government over individual autonomy, and almost every time this question comes up. So my feeling is that when there is a tie or a close call, the true libertarian response has to be to defer to the individual's decision, the individual autonomy. But so many times we don't even have those close calls, and we still have our finger on the scale for the government.
Thank you.
I know you were staying there for a while. It has to be very quick. It could be the last question.
It's a very quick question. Some of the panelists and questioners have privileged the physician-patient relationship, but physicians do derive part of their authority from state licensing regimes, and I'm curious how these arguments that we've been talking about interact with that. We've talked a lot about federal regulation. Thank you.
Is your questions about the state licensure? And well, I mean, I guess I would just say that it is true that states have an enormous power, breathtaking power, over a physician's ability to be able to practice his or her profession. And I think that more conversation has to be devoted to that as well, because frankly, physicians may be free to take certain steps, but if they do so, their medical licenses can be in jeopardy. And that's another way, as you rightly pointed out, that the physician-patient relationship is harmed.
Okay. And before we conclude, I want to remind everyone to stay here in this room. We will have the Bork Memorial Lecture featuring the Honorable Lawrence Silberman. But I want to thank all the panelists here for their wonderful discussion today.